I'm Bill Radke. This is KUOW Seattle, and thank you for tuning in. What would it take for you to march in the streets? How about science? In about a month, Saturday, April 22nd, it's not only Earth Day, it's March for Science Day. Nationwide, in Seattle, in Olympia, Port Angeles, Coopville, and more, appreciators of science will march because of what their website calls the mischaracterization of science as a partisan issue. But are marches like this powerful? They certainly get our attention. Inauguration Day March, Women's March, Black Lives Matter. But then a few years ago, the Occupy Wall Street marches got our attention, protesting inequality and corporate greed. And this week, NPR's Eric Westervelt profiled one of the activists who launched the Occupy movement. His name is Micah White, and he now sees mass street protests and sit-ins as ineffectual, even counterproductive. White says march organizers were fetishizing the pageantry of protest and confusing online social marketing with real change.
Success now has become something like getting a lot of people to hear about my meme. We have become obsessed with the spectacle of street protest, and we have started to ignore the reality that we are getting no closer to power. I mean, you would think that with the triumph of Trump, there would be a fundamental reassessment among activists. But there hasn't been. You know, they've just doubled down on the same behaviors.
White now encourages any progressive angry at President Trump, go local and small to foster big change. Create progressive pockets of power. Organize. Put down the protest sign. Pick up the city budget. Zoning is sexy.
So, while marching protesters chant, "This is what democracy looks like," Michael White is telling you, no, democracy looks like city budgets. Marching feels good, but if you don't like Trump, you have to do more.
You know, there is no other option. I mean, we could have large-scale marches for every year of Trump's presidency. It would do nothing.
Do you agree with that? Marches do nothing? And if so, what is the answer? Wherever you are on the political spectrum, this is a question for Republicans and independents and everyone. How powerful can you be and how? My next guest says you are more powerful than you think. You can discuss that with him right now. We'll take a few phone calls at 206-543-5869. How powerful are you feeling these days? 206-543-5869. Eric Liu advised President Clinton on domestic policy. He founded the nonprofit Citizen University. His new book is called You're More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. Eric Liu, welcome back to KUOW.
Great to be here, Bill.
You just heard that Occupy Wall Street activist say that social media protests are ineffectual. Marches are counterproductive. What do you think of that?
I think it goes too far. I think protests, marches, things in this nature are necessary but not sufficient. We have seen very tangibly and viscerally the ways in which these kinds of face-to-face mobilizations of many, many people do in fact change the game of civic life. They've changed the frame of the possible. They've drawn limits around what this administration thinks it can do or get away with. And I think it matters. The key is not to make it an either-or, is to say, well, how do you build upon this and make it a both-and? So you have marches. You have protests. That's awesome. You're sending a public, visible message. And though I love the alliteration that he's, you know, making fun of the pageantry of protest, mm-hmm. Beyond that, you do have to convert then that protest into durable forms of power. So then you've got to be able to read the map of who decides. So who does decide?
Yeah, read that map for us, will you?
Well, it depends on the issue. I mean, if the issue is homelessness in Seattle, then you've got to understand the county council, the city council. You've got to understand the terrain of all these nonprofit organizations that have been serving homeless families and people. You've got to understand the business community and their both altruistic and material interest in addressing this problem.
That's a lot of understanding. Isn't that why we outsource activism to the people who can focus on it?
That's not a lot of understanding. That's just knowing where you live. That's just being awake and aware to what's going on around you. And I think the myth or the idea that that's someone else's problem, someone else's worry, that's above my pay grade or someone else's concern, is a very self-fulfilling message of disempowerment, right? I think the responsibility we have right now is to get literate in power, to be able to read it and write it. And to read it means to understand who is making decisions, and to write it means to insert yourself into that decision-making process. And these are things that we're not born knowing how to do. We have to practice doing them. And to me, one of the reasons why I am excited about not just the marches and protests, but this surge of civic action that's going on all around the country right now is that people who have been on the sidelines for a long, long time in civic life are stepping back out into the field. They're stretching, they're exercising muscle again. And yeah, some of them have overdone it and they're now throwing up and, you know, feeling out of shape. But they are learning, too, that you pace yourself, you build skill, you build muscle, and together we can actually make more durable change than just those moments of spectacle.
Eric Liu, you said you've been excited by the pushback against President Trump. What is your evidence that it's actually effective or will be effective, that it's not just spectacle?
Well, I want to make two things clear. Number one, I am personally excited about that, but I, in my work at Citizen University, I'm excited about bottom-up citizen power no matter where it's coming from, right?
So, how do you know this is power?
Well, here's the thing. If you rewind to the Tea Party, like my policy preferences are nothing like the Tea Party's, but I love the way that in 2010, those folks organized. They mobilized. They identified the pressure points in particular members of Congress, their town meetings, the decision-making that went on, and they knew how to bring people to bear and get people who hadn't been participating involved in the game, right? Today's resistance protesters and activists and everyday citizens need to take a page from the playbook of the Tea Party. And indeed, one of the most viral phenomenon right now in this Trump resistance is called Indivisible. Right, mm-hmm. grew out of a handbook that a few congressional staffers wrote about how to apply pressure and jujitsu your member of Congress. And that thing's gone viral, not just on social media, but it's become the anchor for 6,000 face-to-face chapters of everyday Americans coming together and applying pressure. What's the evidence? The fact that Trump Care, the proposed repeal and half replacement of the Affordable Care Act, died before it could even get legislated, right?
I've interviewed, by the way, you mentioned the group Indivisible. Maybe we can tweet out a link to my interview with the head of the group Indivisible. I talked to him and a Tea Party member. We talked about some of these issues.
You bet.
But, you know, a liberal would tell you, I would think, yeah, the Tea Party has power because they are aligned with the capitalists. Of course they can get stuff done. What about the powerless?
Oh, I think that we do live in this age where profound inequality and concentration of wealth mean that people on the right and the left want to knock over the establishment. And that's why Donald Trump as a phenomenon was not alone. The Bernie Sanders phenomenon was just the same part of just the same story, right? And to me, it's less.
Well, what did Bernie Sanders accomplish? What did that movement accomplish?
We are still in the midst of what it's accomplishing, right? When you said earlier, or that clip you played earlier said that Occupy didn't accomplish anything, I beg to differ.
Mm-hmm.
Occupy begat $15 Now, which changed the life of the city of Seattle, but it's also changing cities all around the country, right? It changed the economic narrative of where prosperity comes from. Now, are there lots of Occupy chapters still active today? Maybe not. But in the sense of the civic ecosystem, they did their thing. They had their day, and that fed into the mulch out of which all of these other movements have grown, right? And I think this is the same with the Sanders movement, which, he didn't become president, and he's unlikely ever again to run for president. But that doesn't mean that the millions of people, particularly young people who hadn't previously been engaged, who were for Sanders, aren't now also part of this renewal of everyday citizen power. They are part of they are among the people who were swarming to airports and train stations when the Muslim ban was issued. They are among the people who have been not only applying pressure, but cheering on people like our attorney general, who's helped to stop that ban in its tracks in the courts, right? And so this kind of people power matters when it's coupled with an understanding of social norms power, ideas power, state power, money power. Pick your issue, right? Think about how marriage equality became the law of the state and the law of the land. Think about how marijuana legalization happened, right? It wasn't just because a few people in a small room decided to make it so. It was because there was this bottom-up coordination of voice and power that worked with leaders and catalysts to change the frame of the possible. And I think that's happening as we speak with lots of people from these movements that you might say didn't quote-unquote succeed, and I would only say yet.
Eric Liu is our guest. He advised President Clinton when it came to domestic policy and national security, and he founded Citizen University, and his book is called You're More Powerful Than You Think, and I'm inviting listeners to question you about that. How powerful are you in a political system? I'm going to be the cynic to your optimist here, because I understand the people who say corporations and billionaires can write checks to politicians at will. Legislators are usually in safe districts. I'm busy working for a paycheck and protesting and organizing and learning, as you said, about the King County government, et cetera, doesn't feed my family. If a listener has a question that you can help on, that they can consult with you, I'd like for that to happen at 206-543-5869, 543-5869. What about marching in Seattle? Is it fair to say that that's too easy, that you can get 1,000 people at Pioneer Square and think you're doing more than you really are because you're in a bubble? Or is that unfair?
Well, it depends on the issue. I mean, if you're marching in Seattle on something that is a national political issue on which progressives agree, you're kind of preaching to the converted. But if you're marching in Seattle and organizing 1,000 people to stop the building of a youth jail, or to fight,
which hasn't happened yet, said the word yet earlier.
Yeah, organizing 1,000 people to protest and push against the displacement of people who are being forced out by gentrification. If you're mobilizing 1,000 people to march for a radically different approach to affordable housing in this town, those aren't red, blue, left, right, Democrat, Republican issues. Those are issues within the context of our city about, do we really believe in inclusion or not? Right. And so those kinds of issues, marches can matter. But, again, marches, while necessary, are insufficient. Mm-hmm. And you were talking earlier, Bill, just about the sense that lots of people have that corporations have rigged the game, and who am I? I'm busy. I've got work. I've got a family to feed, and so on. And look, I want to return to the $15 Now campaign, because that's now a national phenomenon and it's a buzzword and there's a movement. But let's rewind to when a group of baggage handlers and hotel workers and airport workers in SeaTac decided that they were going to organize.
Busy
people who are working two shifts, who are barely making ends meet, who are at the front of the line of people who have plenty of excuses to say, I'm too busy to participate. And they participated. They showed up. They learned to give public speeches. They learned to mobilize and activate their coworkers and their neighbors in SeaTac, right? And that changed the game in that town, which then changed the game in this town in Seattle. And the contagion that is continuing to spread around the country began with people who had every right to say, I don't got time for that, right? I think that if a baggage handler in SeaTac who was working two jobs made time to change the game and change the story of power, then just about anybody else in this community has no excuse for carving out some time and some mental space for figuring out how you can engage and contribute to the health and the life of the community.
You're more powerful than you think, says and writes our guest Eric Liu, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. We have a question or a comment for you. Sarah in Issaquah, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you. First of all, I want to say I'm thrilled that you have Eric Liu on today. I'm really excited about the book and can't wait to read it.
You might see him speaking at Elliott Bay tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Go on.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. Thank you. I really am moved by this construct. People have been saying to me, why march and kind of discounting that. And I am absolutely in agreement that it is both and. Absolutely in agreement that you can do this. I'm completely inspired myself by working with the system with the precinct committee officers. And we went from 22 last summer to 90 now. We're going to get to 177 in the fifth. We're completely motivated, which is an outcropping of what happened with the marches. So I don't march. I don't do the postcards. I do call. I don't show up at the rallies, but I put intense effort into getting citizen leaders in their, patriot leaders in their neighborhoods to be resources for those who do want to march, for those who do want to be active, or who want to send emails or call or whatever their form is, that we have a structure and a system that's working with Indivisible. We're partnering with those that don't want to be part of the party, but want to be part of the activism, and we're doing both and.
So Sarah, you're in Congressman Dave Reichert's district?
Yes.
Yeah.
And 20 indivisible, 20 CD8 in the CD8.
I want to hear from Eric Liu. I want to hear from Eric Liu. First, I just want to know, do you have any, there might be listeners saying, you're organizing, and has it worked? What do you have to say? What's your evidence, or what's your hope?
Oh my gosh, yeah, we meet every the second Wednesday of every month.
Yeah, you meet
in training.
Yeah,
and we have filled. We've gone from 22 precinct committee officers to 90. So people are engaged. They're active. They're finding ways that they can participate in their own neighborhoods, in their precincts. And they get involved with Indivisible, or they get involved with writing letters, or they get involved with the emails,
okay.
and they work as PCOs, or they work with each other.
Eric?
So it's been terrific.
Bill, one of the things implied in your question here of has it worked, calls to mind that—
I'm not a patient man
by
nature.
Man, and we don't live in a patient time, and yet I think that— there's two ways to answer the has it work question. You know, number one, like I said earlier, not yet, but these processes unfold. And Dave Reichert's feeling the pressure and the heat from his own constituents, as are many, members of Congress right now. But the other way to answer the question is it's working because people are getting offline and seeing each other face to face and building this kind of capacity, right? They are just—
You said that by itself is important.
That by itself.
Congregating.
Absolutely. I mean, we have—
Why? Why is that such— Even apolitically, why is that important?
Look, if you use a metaphor of the body politic and civic health, you think about these muscles that we have to organize, to talk to each other, to see each other. These are muscles that have long been atrophying, right? Social media and technology sometimes feeds the atrophy. But the reality is right now that— Before you get to policy, before you get to Committee X or Subcommittee Y, you know, debating HR, whatever it is, we've got to rebuild the ability to actually look neighbors in the eye, to listen to them, and to listen to them not so that you can prepare to win an argument, but actually full body get a sense of who are you? What are you scared of? What are you hoping for, right? And rebuild that humanization of community and politics. That it is the evaporation of that capacity that begat Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not the cause of our political illness. He's the symptom of it, right? He emerged because for decades now, decades in which we've been experiencing this squeeze and inequality and this isolation of technology, we have forgotten to see each other, to hear each other, to organize each other. And look, my general advice for people right now about this moment is start a club or join a club, anything. It doesn't even have to be a political one. It can be about stamp collecting or cats. I don't care, right? But just the ability to say, I'm going to get a few people together, maybe people I've lived next to all my life and have never exchanged more than pleasantries with, maybe strangers. I'm going to get some people together, and we're going to plan something together. We're going to plan a meeting. We're going to plan an event. We're going to do some stuff together. That's muscle building that when the time comes, when Muslim Ban 3 comes down, when our undocumented friends and neighbors get rounded up en masse, that the body politic is ready to respond, right? And I think this stuff matters in a way that's not just about the checklist of the progress of a particular bill or policy in a legislature.
You know, what's interesting about that to me is that I often hear people talk about reaching across to the other side. There's an other side, and I'm going to understand the other side, and I'm going to make peace with the other side. But I wonder if that's a partisan, like a conversion narrative, that's actually not helpful. So when you're talking about getting together to have a book club or whatever it is, or go see a baseball game, that maybe you'll just mix with people who incidentally might be different from you, but you're not trying to convert the wrong people.
Look,
you know what I mean?
It's got to be all of the above here. Sarah, that last caller was talking about, she's not going to be the one who goes to marches, but she's doing the infrastructure building and the groundwork laying for other people who will. You got to pick your angle in and just pick something to do, right? So for some people, doing right-left bridge building will really be their thing.
Mm.
And I say more power to you.
Okay.
For other people, it's about building up the muscle of Team Blue or Team Red. And I say, go do your thing, right? The message right now is that whether you come from the right or the left, people are revolting against top-down binary hierarchies of our politics. They hate the duopoly of party politics. They hate the way in which so much is top down and push down in this broadcast way. And I think right now they hate the way in which so many people who are elite or establishment get to run the show. And so you're seeing this across the board. Again, this is what fed Trump's phenomenon, and it's what's feeding so much of the progressive activism today, is a great pushback against those forces.
I think we have time for one more call for Eric Liu, author most recently of You're More Powerful Than You Think. He was talking about citizens getting together. But we have this call from Ovi in Othello. Ovi, what's your take on that?
So I agree with Eric. Personally, I don't feel very powerful, but mostly because there is no sense of community. Neighbors try to avoid each other instead of trying to get to know each other and try to talk, mostly because individuality is very priced and valued. But I think our identity is communal. It's not individual, and it's hard. My question would be, how do you get neighbors to talk to you? How do you get to talk to your neighbors? And more importantly, how do you get to understand that we are all workers, we are all people on the same side, we don't want our rent to go up, and we don't want to have a bad job. We all want a good economy. We may disagree on how, but we have an end goal, and we can feed each other's ideas. So
good, yeah.
How do we get that through to everyone?
Ovi, good question. How?
You know, I served a decade on the board of the Seattle Public Library, and during those years was when the system was building out all the branches that were part of the libraries for all bond measure, right? Either building or renovating 27 branches around the city, and of course our great central library. And one of the things that we did in every community of the city that sounds really corny. In fact, it just is corny.
Corny alert. Here it comes.
Were these meetings that were called Hopes and Dreams meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in earnest going to South Park, going to the ID, going to Ballard, right, going to Lake City, and saying, hey, this ballot measure is passed. There is a levy that's going to build or renovate this library. What are your hopes and dreams for a Lake City branch? What are your hopes and dreams for what South Park could get in a brand new branch? What are your hopes?
Good for you. People are corny. I love hopes and dreams.
But here's the thing. When you extend an invitation like that,
yeah,
people respond.
Mm-hmm.
And what Ovi was just saying here is that nobody's extending an invitation. And the vacuum's getting filled by people like Trump who give permission for all our worst sides and for our most negative sides, right? But I would just say to Ovi, you got to be the one to extend the invitation. Like, it's not someone else's job. Just say, you know what? I want to get a group of us together and let's talk about what are our hopes and dreams for people in the Othello neighborhood? What are our hopes and dreams for South Seattle? What do we want to do? And maybe invite a politician, maybe invite a business person, maybe invite a faith leader. I don't know what, but here's the thing. One of the laws of power that I write about in this book, which bears more discussion, we can talk about it tomorrow night at Elliott Bay at 7, is this. Power is infinite. People think that power in civic life is the zero-sum thing, and there's only a certain amount, and if you've got some, it's got to be to my detriment.
Right.
No. You learning how to organize, you learning how to give a public speech does not make me any less capable of organizing or giving a speech. You've just added to the total amount of power in the system, right? Mm. And the thing about that is that how do you create power out of thin air? You do it by organizing. Organizing is magic, right? And organizing is not magical in the sense that only a few wizards know how to do it. You can do it just by knocking on your neighbor's door and saying, you know what? I've been noticing that our block is having this problem or this trouble. Or you know what? You know, I'm a little worried about what's going on in our neck of the woods here. What do you think? Should we get some people together in the living room for coffee sometime? Just that unleashes the magic of organizing out of which all civic power is built.
Whatever your politics are, knock, organize. Eric Liu is showing you how. The book is You're More Powerful Than You Think. He'll be at Elliott Bay, 7 o'clock tomorrow, and April 8th at Town Hall. And I love that we're talking about hopes and dreams and organizing and power. Eric Liu, always good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bill. Great to be with you.
More of KUOW's The Record in just a moment. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. If you're a man playing for U.S. hockey, congratulations. You've been getting a full salary, and USA Hockey pays for you to travel business class to the Olympics. If you're a woman playing for USA Hockey, no salary. You got $6,000 pay for the 6 months you spent training for the Olympics, and you were stuck in coach. But now, after months of sometimes ugly and public negotiations, including players boycotting the upcoming Hockey World Championships, women USA Hockey players will get paid salaries for the first time. Jenny Gilder is co-owner of the Seattle Storm, our WNBA team, and she says fights like this to get equitable pay for professional women athletes are often a bigger clash between social justice and economics.
The narrative about women in sport is still dominated by men. The idea that women belong in sports at the highest level is not one that I would say is really embraced yet by the modern world. So
I thought most people feel that women belong in sports, but then now we're talking about how much money they make.
Yeah, well, they belong in sports as amateurs for sure. But when you're talking about the highest levels, then there seems to be this point of view that's evidenced by the lack of attendance, certainly anywhere near comparable attendance to men's events.
Why do you think that is?
You know, if I knew why that is, I probably would be able to have it create a solution. We still live in a culture that is focused on men. And I mean, that I don't mean that to sound like sour grapes, but for a long time across the world, men have set the narrative for all aspects of life.
It seemed like the negotiations about the pay for women's hockey players sort of took off when the male players with USA Hockey started getting into it. Is that right? And how should we view that?
You know, I'm not sure that's right. It might be that they were the icing on the cake. Mm. You look at what was happening last weekend with respect to this issue, and the first thing that happened was that USA Hockey was going to the next tier of athletes, asking them to participate, step into, if you will, the shoes of the strikers, right, of the women who were boycotting. And what was the first thing that happened? And they said, hell no. And that was, the most important first step. So the women started standing together. And then the men in the sporting world who saw what was happening, then they stood up too. Now, if they hadn't stood up, would the women have won? I don't know. I mean, very possibly. You had 16 U.S. senators standing up. You had Billie Jean King. You had the narrative, if you will, shifting all across the sports spectrum and beyond. And I don't know that it was just the men. Or, you know, if that was without them, it wouldn't have happened. At that point, it might have just been piling on. I think USA
Hockey. So maybe I just regurgitated the sexist version of what happened?
Maybe. USA Hockey should feel profoundly embarrassed that they went to these young women and asked them to step over the women who were taking a stand. But I think that story, that's the crux of the story right there, is that the girls and young women saw this as what it was. You know, pitting women and girls against each other.
You, as I said, you own a women's basketball team. You co-own the Seattle Storm in Seattle. You think about the economics of the sport. What do you make of your players making so much less than male NBA players?
Well, I make of it a couple of things. First of all, I think men's professional athletes are paid way too much. So that's not the model I would aspire to as a team owner.
Really? Okay. So if you could get more for your players, you
don't
think
that's...
I
would love to get more for my players, but I wouldn't want. I don't think that should be the goal, making tens of millions of dollars. I think that creates a huge disconnect between the average fan and the athlete, and I don't think that's healthy.
Why is that unhealthy?
Because whether athletes like it or not, they are role models for their communities, and it's hard for a regular human being to look up to an athlete when their worlds are so completely different. Money has a funny way of unbalancing the field of life, if you will. And one thing I would say about our players, WNBA players, is they still recognize what a privilege it is to get to play the sport they love professionally. Now, I'm not saying that men don't feel that way. I'm just saying I know what the women are like in the WNBA. I would love for them to earn more. But more than having them earn more, what I would love is for more fans to come out and see them and be inspired by them. And that would lead to more economic benefit for them.
What is standing in the way of more Seattle fans coming to Storm games?
You know, I don't really know that answer, other than kind of the broader culture's perspective on women professional athletes. That somehow women are not viewed as to be as interesting as athletes, to be as competitive. I don't know. There is a narrative out there about what it means to be an athlete. You're the strongest. You're the fastest. You're the most, you know, adept at making amazing plays. And that is viewed from a predominantly male perspective. So women don't quite fit in there. But I say this, you know, the league has been around. We're in our 21st season. It takes a while to change a narrative. Look at slavery in this country, right? Look at how we view African Americans. It takes decades to change a narrative.
We started out, by the way, I'm talking with Ginny Gilder, co-owner of the Seattle Storm, our WNBA team. We started out talking about economics and social justice, and you have said that you see young players getting more active in pushing for social justice in general. How are you seeing that in your players?
Well, you see that across the WNBA. You saw last year where players really took a stand on Black Lives Matter after the shootings. We see it with our newest player, who was last year's Rookie of the Year, Breanna Stewart. She was actively involved after the Florida shootings. She was part of the our whole team led the way on Black Lives Matter, thinking about how they wanted to show up as a group. Then when Trump signed his first executive order on immigration, she was at the LAX airport. She uses social media to communicate what she wants to support. Of course, 15 years ago, we didn't have social media, so I think players today understand that they have a platform and feel they have a responsibility to use it, and that's not just in women's basketball. Today's players are much more aware of where they are as athletes, partly because of Title IX and the huge opportunity that they have been given, and they want to continue to build on that.
Is there any significant fan backlash like we heard about with, for example, Colin Kaepernick, the 49ers, the ex-quarterback?
I think there are...
Standing, by the way, kneeling at the national anthem,
right,
for those who don't know.
I think there are isolated cases where fans are not happy when players, I wouldn't use this language, cross the line into doing something, talking about more than just sport. I think that players are, you know, human beings who have full capacities and opportunities to talk about matters that are important to them. I would say in Seattle, we get very little backlash.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a city that is deeply, deeply liberal, committed to equality. So for us, it's not an issue.
Ginny Gilder of Seattle Storm, let's wrap this up by finally getting back to the director, executive director of USA Hockey, telling ESPN that these negotiations got ugly. I wonder, what advice do you give them about repairing relationships with the athletes?
Well, I think acknowledging the validity of the athlete's perspective, being graceful in defeat, is always a great way to go.
Ginny Gilder, Seattle Storm, it's good to talk with you again. Will you come in and come into the studio in person and hang out?
Sure. Well, will you come to a basketball game?
Yeah. Oh, Ginny, you weren't there when my daughter lit up at a Minnesota game. She was she thought that Sue Bird was called Super, and so she was chanting Super for days afterward. So thanks for a great time.
Well, our tip off for the season is May 14th, coming up.
May 14th. Looking forward to it, Ginny. Thank you.
Thank you.
KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. When Eric Vance was an 18-month-old baby, he came down with a serious illness, possibly Legionnaire's disease. But Eric's parents were Christian Scientists, and instead of taking him to a hospital, they brought in a healer and prayed for him, and their son miraculously recovered. Eric is now a science journalist, and his book is called Suggestible You, The Curious Science of Your Brain's Ability to Deceive, Transform, and Heal. Eric Vance told Deborah Wong that he wrote the book as he tried to figure out his own experiences with unexplained healing.
How did things that I saw, the healings that I saw, not just from me, but in the community I lived in, how did those things happen? These people are not crazy. They're not stupid. They're acting logically, and they are getting better. So what's happening? It actually came into clarity when I it started to come into clarity when I went to a brain science meeting a number of years ago, and I saw a talk on the placebo effect and how the placebo effect operates in the brain. And I looked at the speaker, and it was a name that I recognized as being another Christian Scientist, a former Christian Scientist who was in a very similar position to me. And a light went off in my head. It was just like, wow, it's like a Catholic studying the brain state of guilt, It's like, wow, what a perfect thing to study. And what they've learned, what scientists have learned, is that there's actually an entire pharmacy inside of our heads, mm-hmm. that medicate us based on our expectation. Your brain is a prediction machine, and it makes predictions all day long. It's pretty much all your brain does. And your brain doesn't want to be wrong. It doesn't want those predictions to be incorrect. So if you're a little off, it will drop in drugs in order to make expectation meet reality. And that's what a placebo effect is. It's just your brain making up the difference. And it can be a very powerful thing.
Do placebos work the same for everybody, or is there a difference in our personalities?
The easy answer is no. For many decades, scientists have been trying to understand if there's a certain person out there, the certain placebo responders, kind of like the holy grail for people in this field. Is there someone who responds to placebos consistently more than other people? And it's been hard to find. Scientists have looked at, they've looked at race, they've looked at gender, they've looked at age, they've looked at personality types, hypnotizability, all kinds of different things. And it just hasn't worked out. Hypnotizability is a great example because that's something that doesn't change. It tends to stay the same throughout your life. Placebos, one day to the next, one person to the next, one drug to the next, it changes a lot. And that's a lot of that's because of the chemistry and now maybe even the genetics. And not only that, but it also varies from one condition to the next. Okay. And that's actually a better place to look for interesting science, because if you look at things like Parkinson's disease, chronic pain, depression, anxiety, even some autoimmune diseases and asthma, these things respond very well to placebos. Your mind and your expectation has a huge effect on these conditions. Other things like Alzheimer's disease or a tumor don't respond very well to placebos. And so what that tells me is there are rules. There are rules that can be followed. There are laws at work that we just don't understand fully yet.
Rules like what? What do you need to make a placebo work?
Well, so these are some of the things that scientists are trying to figure out. And let's take pain. In the case of pain, your brain actually has endogenous opioids. And we've heard a lot about opioids over the past few years and the effects that they can have on people. But you have opioids in your brain. You also have endocannabinoids, which are some of the same chemicals you see in marijuana. You have serotonin. You have dopamine. You have all these different chemicals. They can be very powerful drugs. And in the case of pain, if you take a pill and you expect that pill to take your pain away, and it's not, and it's an inert pill, your brain can step in and release its own opioids to make the pain go away. If you expect it, I'll say, if you expect it enough, then this can happen. And so that's a chemical reaction. That's something you can understand as a scientist. You can piece these things together. And there's certain conditions in which opioids are very useful, and others where it's not. Same with dopamine. Parkinson's is very useful to have extra dopamine floating around in your brain, but for, say, obsessive compulsive disorder, it's not. And so these things, that's the rules that we're sort of piecing out, is which chemicals do we have access to and which ones are helpful for which conditions.
You write about a researcher who conducted a study in which she gave, I believe it was pain medication to patients, and then gradually took away those pain meds and gave them more and more placebos over the course of time, and found that people didn't really notice that their pain meds were going away and they were getting placebos because they looked the same and they assumed that they had those expectations that they were getting their pain meds. And I guess that's amazing to me. And it also might feel like, I think it might feel a little disappointing to people that they are being tricked into having the same response than if they were actually taking the medications. I mean, is there a sense of like, my gosh, what's wrong with my brain? I'm being tricked.
That's kind of a pessimistic way to look at it. I didn't think of you as a pessimist. yeah, no, it's absolutely, I get that. Her name is Luana Coloca, and she's an amazing researcher out of University of Maryland right now. And actually, that hasn't been published yet, so I'm still a little vague on the details until it gets fully published. But what she saw is, and it's a similar thing that we see in a lot of conditions, is that it's not so much that you don't need those drugs. Well, we're still figuring this out exactly how this works, but it looks like it's not so much that you don't need those drugs. It's that over time, your brain learns to regulate itself. It has its own store of drugs. It has its own homeostasis that it's trying to find, which is, you know, a level of no pain. And your brain sort of figures out where that spot is. And the drugs can, you know, it can certainly help with immediate pain, but then over time, it can help sort of ease you in your brain into the point where it can regulate itself. Because like I said, it has the drugs on hand. It's just a matter of trying to figure out, and there's a theory out there that a lot of chronic pain is related to your brain simply not knowing the right levels for its own self-medication and being a little off, and so you have residual pain.
So if it's true that the mind is a really powerful healer, and as you say, there's this pharmaceutical cabinet in our brains ready to go to respond to pain or injury, why do we need to spend so much money on doctors? I mean, why do we need to take all these pharmaceuticals? Is there a different way?
You know, it's different for everybody, and there's a balance in our lives. And there are, you know, take cancer. If belief has a powerful effect on the symptoms of cancer, you know, the pain, the nausea, and the symptoms of treatment as well, you know, depression, like there can be a lot that belief, placebos, alternative medicine, you know, these things can be very helpful for people, but for the actual tumor themselves, all indications are that they don't. We don't have much access to tools to remove a tumor from ourselves. We need to understand the limits, the possibilities, and the limits of our own brains. And in the case of cancer, you know, there's a limit, and we need to go to the doctor, you know, for those things where our brains are limited. But where there are possibilities, and people say, oh, should we be prescribing placebos? Well, we already do. You know, 70% of doctors say they occasionally prescribe placebos, and for those that don't, I mean, those of us who are patients, we go to alternative medicine. We try different supplements that clearly are not doing anything beyond triggering the placebo effect. But we do it anyway. And this is how, and I do it. I take these sort of fizzy drink supplement things that, because, and the fizziness, I swear the fizziness is what does it for me. I love a fizzy drink, and I know it feels like it's doing something. You know, and it's that feeling. And I know I'm tricking myself, but the science actually shows that even if you know it's happening, even if you know it might be a placebo, it can still work. And it's because a lot of this is unconscious. And I take like raw garlic, another one that I do, and it's, boy, it just, you know, it's a very unpleasant experience, but it feels like it's doing something to you. And so we can tap into these things within reason, and I lay out some guidelines in the book, but within reason we can tap into these things, at the same time knowing that for other conditions, a conventional doctor is really the way to go.
Eric Vance, a science writer for Nature, The New York Times, National Geographic, and more. His book is Suggestible You, The Curious Science of Your Brain's Ability to Deceive, Transform, and Heal. We're tweeting out a link to one of his articles right now. It's called The Science of Miracles. So join us on Twitter at KUOW. This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. 100 miles. That's the distance between Seattle and Canada, but it feels like a world away sometimes. This is the United States Attorney General Jeff Sessions warning states like Washington, where marijuana is legal.
States can pass whatever laws they choose, but I'm not sure we're going to be a better, healthier nation if we have marijuana being sold at every corner grocery store.
Meanwhile, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, what is Canada doing about marijuana?
We're going to work with the provinces to make sure that the control and regulation of marijuana is done in a way that is responsible and suitable.
Two different national directions. And now we even have a date certain for legal Canadian weed. It's going to happen on Party Day. Here to explain, Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Happy Canada Day 2018, huh?
July the 1st, 2018 is Marijuana Legalization Day in Canada. It's Canada Day, and I don't know. I can't resist saying that it may put new meaning to some words in the national anthem about from far and wide we see thee rise. No. Anyway, we'll all be joking about it, but it's a pretty big deal. The Prime Minister Trudeau ran for office in 2015. Legalization was one of the promises he made, and this one he says he's going to keep. We get more details in early April, but the CBC broke the big story this week that Legalization Day, the target date, is the 1st of July, 2018.
Canada Day, the annual Fête du Canada. Now, Justin Trudeau is not using the libertarian smoke-free or die argument. What are his reasons for legalizing marijuana nationally?
Well, I will say that, first of all, Bill, it's a political problem that the Prime Minister faced. He made 200 promises when he was running for office in 2015, including a lot of promises he made back when he wasn't even sure he was going to win the election. And he's broken some of those promises, and I think there was a big speculation nationally that he was going to back away from this one. So part of it is that he promised. But the other thing is the main argument for legalization is the use of marijuana is so widespread anyway, but the trade is to a great degree in the hands of criminals, and there are few safeguards to keep the product out of the hands of children. So the Prime Minister's pitch is very much that legalization will bring it under government control. It will keep it out of the hands of children. It'll put limits on people growing it in their own homes. And not incidentally, Bill, it will become a major source of revenue for Canada's governments. The estimate is maybe $500 million, depending on how they do it.
And it's divvied up. The responsibilities kind of split between the national and and governments like British Columbia.
The classic Canadian solution to things. You know, our healthcare system is regulated federally, but the system is mostly delivered by provinces. And this will allow cities and provinces some leeway in the details, the nuts and bolts of legalization, where the stuff will be available, how it will be sold, what products can be sold. That's essentially what the government is promising. So the heavy regulation will be done at the national level, but the implementation will be handled provincially, and I think you may see as well locally, so that some cities will have a lot less access in towns than some of the bigger urban centers.
That sounds simple. What has been most difficult or is likely to be most difficult about legalizing marijuana nationally?
Oh, what do you do about impaired driving? I mean, you folks know this down south of the border of Washington. Can you really get the drug trade out of the hands of the criminals after you have let them into it? I mean, do they just switch to tougher drugs? Keeping an eye on kids getting access is not going to be easy. And look, I mean, your attorney general has a point. There are people who say that, you know, marijuana is a very dangerous drug and addictive, and, you know, what do you do when somebody shows up at work? Landlords. Big issue with landlords. Someone in your building right now has a permit to grow marijuana for medical purposes, because that's already legal here. They don't have to register with the landlord, so they start growing the stuff. Marijuana smoke, marijuana grow-ups have water issues, power issues. Marijuana smoke starts pervading the place. The tenant upstairs is allergic. Can you evict the person? Well, they don't even have to disclose that they're able to do it. So, you know, I think we're kidding ourselves if we think this is going to go smoothly. The one thing I gather from reading the experience in the American states that have done this is there's a whole bunch of problems we've just begun to contemplate.
Indeed. We have a minute left or so, Vaughn, and I read that this new announcement of a date certain for legalization boosted the stock prices of Canada's big marijuana producers. How is weed publicly traded in Canada if it's not yet legal?
These are companies that have that are licensed by the national government to produce marijuana for medicinal purposes. So there's a bunch of companies out there. They're really not very big yet, but of course they're hoping to capitalize on this coming marijuana trade.
Fascinating. We will follow it together with Vaughn Palmer, Vancouver Sun columnist. Good to talk with you again, Vaughn.
Bye-bye, Bill.
Weed legal in Canada on Canada Day 2018. Meanwhile, and by the way, it's not April 20th, right? It's July. April 20th is sort of informally National Weed Day here in the States. And that's because in the 70s, some pot-smoking California high school students used to meet at 4:20 in the afternoon. Thus, events like Seattle's annual 420 Fest, which is going to be April 20th. It's going to bring music and food events to the city in about 3 weeks, Thursday, the 20th of April. Finally, Vaughn mentioned criminals switching to tougher drugs. Some people think marijuana is a gateway drug, an on-ramp to more addictive ways of tuning out. Well, today, President Trump held a listening session on opioid addiction, which the White House says is the beginning of an effort to address a problem that resonated on the campaign trail. That's something you'll hear about this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered.